They have most recently introduced bipartisan bills in the House, just Senator Wyden for now in the Senate. But that's to add protections at the federal level to try to stop the use of slap lawsuits. And that effort is continuing and will hopefully continue to have bipartisan support.
Well, let's maybe close with Deepa Padmanabha, who's Greenpeace's legal advisor. She said that this lawsuit, Energy Transfer versus Greenpeace, is trying to divide people. It's not about the law. It's about public information and public understanding. And she said, quote, "Energy Transfer and the fossil fuel industry do not understand the difference between entities and movements. You can't bankrupt the movement. You can't silence the movement," close quote. I find that powerful. We're in a very scary time. Folks are looking to the law to save us in a place where the law can't necessarily do that. But what are your thoughts, finally, about the importance of this case and what you would hope journalism would do about it?
Well, I think this case is important for Greenpeace, obviously, but as Deepa said, this is important for environmental justice movements and social justice movements more broadly. And I agree with what she said very strongly. I think both Greenpeace and First Rights, where I work, are part of a nationwide coalition called Protect the Protest that was created to help respond to these types of threats that are emerging all over the country. And our mantra is, if you come after one of us, you come after all of us. I think no matter the outcome of this trial, one of the results will be that there will be a movement that is responding to what happened, continuing to work to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable, and also to put a spotlight on Energy Transfer and its record and how it's relating and engaging with the communities where it tries to operate.
We've been speaking with Kirk Herbertson. He's U.S. Director for Advocacy and Campaigns at Earth Rights International. They're online at earthrights.org. Thank you so much, Kirk Herbertson, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find decades of shows on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter, Extra, and it's also the place to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show's engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Trump has declared that the U.S. is going to take over the Gaza Strip, that the Palestinians who live there will be permanently exiled. Again, asked whether Palestinians would have the right to return to Gaza under his scheme, Trump said no. But even those corporate news media who aren't actually endorsing this illegal, inhumane plan still can't seem to find it in themselves to call it what it is, ethnic cleansing. Media critic, activist, and teacher Gregory Shupak has been looking into big media's systematic refusal to use appropriate language about the human rights crimes unfolding before our eyes in Palestine. He teaches English and media studies at the University of Guelph-Humber in Toronto, and he's author of the book The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. Also on the show, there is a deep, if muddled, sense that the U.S. tax system is unfair. The little guy pays too much, and rich folks find loopholes and offshore accounts. But then, on a different page, there's a story about how we, as a country, don't have enough resources to allow school kids to eat lunch, because that would mean the dreaded higher taxes. But we will shell out another billion for a fighter.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
While the money may not be important to Energy Transfer, a $300 million judgment would shut down Greenpeace USA. Our decades-long storied legacy of fighting for people and the planet could come to an end.
A closely watched trial is taking place in North Dakota that could bankrupt Greenpeace and show protest movements across the country. The Texas pipeline company Energy Transfer sued Greenpeace for $300 million over its role supporting the indigenous-led protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. We'll speak to Greenpeace and indigenous water protector Winona LaDuke. Then, we look at the Oscar-nominated film Sugarcane. It's an investigation into devastating abuse at an Indian residential school in Canada.
For decades, there were reports of neglect and children dying or disappearing from this facility.
Two girls drowned. Priests were moved around.
Why are they dying?
Did they think we'd be stupid? All of our lives, the rest of our lives, and nobody would ever find out these things.
We'll speak to Sugarcane co-directors Emily Cassie and Julian Brave Noisecat. His father is the only known survivor of the practice of infanticide at the St. Joseph's Mission School in Canada. Plus, we remember Aaron Bushnell, the 25-year-old active duty Air Force member who self-immolated a year ago outside the Israeli embassy in D.C. to protest U.S. support for Israel. We'll speak to one of his closest friends, as well as an Air Force member who was inspired by Aaron to seek conscientious objector status. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Donald Trump has ordered the U.S. to suspend all military aid to Ukraine. The stunning reversal came just days after Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance berated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office in a shocking confrontation that was broadcast live around the world. On Monday, Trump suggested Zelensky, quote, won't be around very long if he refuses to make a deal with Russia.
President Zelensky supposedly made a statement today in AP. I'm not a big fan of AP, so maybe it was an incorrect statement, but he said he thinks the war's going to go on for a long time. And he better not be right about that. That's all I'm saying.
Trump's shut off of arms shipments prompted shock, anger, and condemnation across Ukraine and much of Europe. Germany's likely next chancellor, Friedrich Merz, called attacks on Zelensky a manufactured escalation. French Prime Minister François Bayrou said Zelensky's treatment was, quote, marked by brutality, a desire to humiliate. And the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk called on European nations to massively increase military spending. Stock prices of European weapons manufacturers soared Monday. Ukrainian officials have pledged to do all they can to keep the U.S. as an ally and reiterated they remain open to a deal on rare earth minerals. Meanwhile, the Kremlin welcomed Trump's suspension of arms to Ukraine, saying it would push Kyiv to the negotiating table. Global stock markets plunged as Trump's 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada and 10% tariffs on China took effect today. At midnight, Canada announced it was imposing 25% tariffs on $30 billion worth of U.S. goods, with an expansion of tariffs planned in 3 weeks. China imposed 15% tariffs on U.S. imports of chicken, wheat, corn, and cotton, and 10% on other U.S. goods, including soybeans, meat, produce, dairy products. Beijing urged the U.S. to abandon its bullying stance and engage in talks instead.
The United States should engage in consultations with China on the basis of equality, mutual respect, and reciprocity to address each other's concerns. However, if the U.S. harbors ulterior motives and insists on waging a tariff war, trade war, or any other kind of war, China will play along to the end.
In addition to hitting the affected industries, consumer prices are expected to increase for a wide range of products, including cars, electronics, gas, and grocery items. Meanwhile, the world's biggest semiconductor chip maker, Taiwan's TSMC, announced another planned $100 billion expansion of its manufacturing operations in the U.S. for a total investment of $165 billion. Cryptocurrency prices briefly spiked Monday after Trump announced plans for a U.S. crypto strategic reserve that includes Bitcoin, Ether, Solana, XRP, and Cardano. Critics say cryptocurrencies are too unpredictable to be a safe choice for a reserve asset. Israeli forces launched fresh attacks on the Gaza Strip Monday, killing at least two people in a drone strike on the southern city of Rafah. Relatives who gathered to mourn the dead condemned Israel for once again violating its ceasefire agreement in Gaza.
How do they say there is a truce? Where is the truce while they are killing people? He went to see his house next to Al-Amina Station, and they killed him.
Separately on Monday, an Israeli helicopter attack in Khan Yunis left three Palestinians injured. Israel's latest ceasefire violations came after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reimposed a total blockade on Gaza hours after the first phase of the ceasefire deal expired. Palestinian officials condemned the renewed siege, saying the use of starvation as a tool of war is a serious violation of international humanitarian law. The cutoff of aid drew condemnation across the Arab world and from countries including Canada, Germany, Spain, and Turkey. On Monday, the U.S. State Department said Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, is headed to the region to broker an extension to the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire deal or to advance to the second phase. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed a young Palestinian man earlier today as they raided a building in the city of Jenin. He's at least the 27th person killed in Jenin and its refugee camp since Israel's military launched what it calls Operation Iron Wall more than 6 weeks ago. Meanwhile, Israeli authorities announced the death of 40-year-old Jenin resident Khalid Abdullah in an Israeli prison where he'd been held for months without charge. The Palestinian Prisoner Society says his death brings the publicly disclosed number of Palestinian prisoners killed in Israeli custody since October to 61. The group reports thousands of prisoners face severe violations, including torture, starvation, sexual assault, unsanitary conditions, and the deprivation of medical treatment. The leader of the Democratic Republic of Congo has ruled out direct talks with M23 after the Rwanda-based group seized eastern cities, including Goma and Bukavu, in an advance that killed at least 8,500 people. On Monday, the United Nations said M23 fighters abducted at least 130 sick and wounded men from two hospitals in the city of Goma last week. Meanwhile, the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports more than 500 patients with the contagious viral disease Mpox have fled clinics in eastern DRC. Africa CDC warns the fighting is worsening an Mpox outbreak that's killed 180 people and sickened nearly 3,000 so far this year. Back in the United States, the former head of the Social Security Administration's warned interference from the Trump administration could result in beneficiaries missing payments within the next 3 months. Martin O'Malley told CNBC, quote, "Ultimately, you're going to see the system collapse and an interruption of benefits. I believe you'll see that within the next 30 to 90 days. O'Malley added that, quote, "people should start saving now," unquote. His warning came after the Social Security Administration notified workers of significant workforce reductions in the days ahead, as billionaire Elon Musk and his Doge operation looked to slash the agency. On Friday, Musk blasted Social Security as a Ponzi scheme in an interview with podcaster Joe Rogan.
Well, I mean, the government's one big pyramid scheme, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, you can tell me better than anybody.
Social Security is the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time.
Fresh protests erupted around Washington, D.C. on Monday, condemning President Trump and Elon Musk's deep cuts to the federal workforce. In Silver Spring, Maryland, hundreds of people rallied in front of the offices of NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, days after the Trump administration laid off 650 NOAA workers nationwide. This is Mike Tidwell, director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network.
I'm here with about 1,000 people at least, demanding that all dismissed workers at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration be reinstated immediately and no further cuts are made. NOAA is critical to safe seafood that we eat, to weather forecasts involving dangerous hurricanes. A million different ways NOAA is a critical part of our lives, and we need to keep this agency strong.
Over 1,000 people protested the NOAA layoffs in Boulder, Colorado as well. Senate Republicans confirmed Linda McMahon as head of the Department of Education Monday in a 51-45 vote. Trump and McMahon have threatened to dismantle public education. Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray spoke out against McMahon's confirmation from the Senate floor.
We need a Secretary of Education who will put students first, not billionaires, who will stand up for our kids, every single one of them, even if it means standing up to Donald Trump and Elon Musk. And Madam President, on each of these accounts, Linda McMahon fails to make the grade.
President Trump's acting U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C. has demoted at least 8 senior federal prosecutors who worked on January 6th Capitol insurrection cases. Ed Martin, who's backed Trump's lies about the 2020 election, reportedly moved some prosecutors to entry-level jobs and compounded internal turmoil at the Justice Department. Last month, Ed Martin declared he and other federal attorneys are Trump's lawyers, in direct contradiction to his oath of office to be an independent, Constitution-abiding officer. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's planned transfer of 10 more immigrants to Guantanamo Bay. If successful, the case could lead to a broader halt on Trump's transfer policy, which legal and rights experts say is unlawful. The Pentagon sending over 5,000 more troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, including a Stryker Brigade combat team. This despite border crossings having sharply dropped in recent weeks. In other immigration news, in Tacoma, Washington, dozens of imprisoned immigrants ended a 3-day hunger strike after ICE promised to address worsening conditions at the Northwest Detention Center. It was the 4th hunger strike since the start of the year. And hundreds of protesters rallied in California's East Bay over the weekend to oppose Trump's proposal to reopen the Dublin Women's Prison as an ICE detention center. The prison was dubbed Rape Club due to rampant sexual abuse by prison staff. This is activist Aimee Chivatte, a former prisoner who survived sexual abuse at the facility. She was a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons.
Nobody understands that the severity, the trauma, the abuse that we went through is inhumane. Me as a U.S. citizen went through trauma, sexual abuse, mental abuse, verbal abuse by the officers that were told to take care of us. We were not taken care of. We did not get medical treatment. If you put immigrants in this ICE detention, let's be real. Nobody cares about them. Nobody cares about immigrants. What kind of help are they going to get? We're going to repeat the story. We're going to repeat the story of abuse.
To see our interview with Aimee Chivatte, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with a closely watched civil trial in North Dakota that could bankrupt the global environmental group Greenpeace. Testimony began last week in a Mandan courthouse just across the Missouri River from Bismarck in a $300 million lawsuit filed by Energy Transfer, the big oil corporation behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Texas company claims Greenpeace USA and Greenpeace International organized the mass protests and encampment at Standing Rock between 2016 and 17 against the construction of the pipeline. Energy Transfer has accused Greenpeace of defamation and orchestrating criminal behavior. Greenpeace has described the trial as one of the most consequential free speech cases in recent history.
This is about our fundamental First Amendment rights, and those rights are under attack. Even if you don't care about climate change, you don't care about Greenpeace, you should pay attention.
Because what's at stake isn't just Greenpeace or environmentalism, but the fundamental right to freedom of expression.
Energy Transfer CEO Kelsey Warren, a major Trump donor since 2016, once referred to water protectors as people who should, quote, be removed from the gene pool, unquote. Greenpeace had petitioned the North Dakota Supreme Court to move the trial out of Morton County, arguing the jury's not partial, not impartial. It was recently reported that more than half the jurors have ties to the fossil fuel industry and most express negative views about anti-pipeline protesters and groups that oppose the fossil fuel industry. For more, we go to Mandan, North Dakota, where we're joined by Deepa Padmanabha, a senior legal advisor for Greenpeace USA, who's attending the civil trial. Deepa, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out what's at stake?
Thanks, Amy. It's so great to be back with you. So as you mentioned, we're in week two of our trial here in Mandan, North Dakota, where Energy Transfer alleges that Greenpeace offices orchestrated the entire resistance at Standing Rock through a misinformation campaign. And these legal attacks against Greenpeace have been going on for almost 8 years. And as you mentioned, they are seeking $300 million in damages. What's really important to know is that, you know, this case is not just an obvious and blatant erasure of Indigenous leadership, of Indigenous resistance, but this case is also so much bigger than just Greenpeace. It is an attack on the broader movement and all of our First Amendment rights to free speech and peaceful protest.
And Deepa, Energy Partners tried to use a RICO lawsuit originally against Greenpeace. Could you talk about this, this tendency now of corporations to go after civil society groups with these lawsuits, especially RICO suits?
Yeah, of course. So the case that we're currently in trial for is a state case, and it's the second lawsuit that Energy Transfer filed against the Greenpeace entities. So back in August of 2017, Energy Transfer filed a federal case in North Dakota federal court alleging RICO violations. And this was the second year in a row that the Greenpeace entities had been hit with civil RICO. And so what these corporations were alleging was that our advocacy work was akin to mafia behavior. And that's what RICO, the Racketeer Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act, was originally intended to address. And so at that time, the lawyers had actually publicly stated that this was the new playbook that they were developing. They were shopping this tactic around. And at that time, it was thought that civil RICO could really be the new tactic that was going to be used to shut down advocacy work. And the really good news there is that we fought those cases head on. And in both cases, we actually got civil RICO dismissed. And so now there is precedent. And I want to note that civil RICO is different from criminal RICO, which is what folks are dealing with in Cop City. And unfortunately, that's still a huge threat. And there is not the same precedent that we have with civil RICO. But we haven't seen new civil RICO cases filed against advocacy groups in that way. But what happened in the Energy Transfer case is when the RICO was dismissed, the federal court did not rule on the state claims. So in 2019, Energy Transfer took those state claims and filed a case in North Dakota State Court. And that's the case that we're currently trying right now in Mandan.
And in terms of the state case, the allegations that Greenpeace is accused of inciting and masterminding the uprising of 2016 and 17, why have they chosen to go after Greenpeace when the reality is that it was Native organizations who led that fight and who organized most of the fight?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And, you know, I've been working on these cases on the Energy Transfer legal attacks for almost 8 years. And anybody familiar with Standing Rock, the first question they always ask me is, was Greenpeace even there? We never heard about them. We never saw them. This makes no sense. And therein lies the truth. It's because Greenpeace recognized that this was an indigenous-led fight. This was not a Greenpeace campaign. I mean, you all know Greenpeace for big, bold actions. That was not at play here, and that was very intentional. This was not our fight. And so I think that the question of why Greenpeace is kind of twofold. I mean, one, the original federal case using RICO, that was kind of a new tactic. And so Greenpeace was, you know, really the guinea pig in that RICO tactic. But second, you know, this is a lawsuit that's really intended to silence, to intimidate, and to scare people into silence. And so the thought is, if we can silence Greenpeace, if we can make them scared, then who else is going to speak out? Who else is going to show up at protests? And so kind of picking from the corporate side, you know, who is the target that can really help us address the rest of civil society? And we believe that that's why they picked Greenpeace. And we don't think that they ever anticipated that 8 years later, we would be here in court, clearly showing that we will not be silenced. And, you know, these attempts to make us weaker, to shut us down, have actually only made us stronger and made the movement more united.
In a minute, we're going to talk to Winona LaDuke to talk about the indigenous-led resistance. But Deepa Padmanabha, before you go into court, for people who don't understand what a slap suit is, and talk about whether this is exactly what the corporations want, you to be in court and not on the street, not protesting pipelines around the country.
Yeah, so that's exactly what the intent is. So SLAP stand for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. And in a nutshell, these are cases that are meant to silence, that are meant to scare, because the idea is not to actually win in court. The idea is that if you bring a massive lawsuit, I mean, any of us can imagine what if we were hit with a $300 million lawsuit, the mere filing of the lawsuit has the intended impact of silencing. And, you know, what I want to say is, you know, to your point, we are absolutely focused on winning in the courtroom, but because we know that this case is so much bigger, we have to win outside of the courtroom as well. And so the way that Greenpeace is fighting this case is obviously not just for our offices, for our entities, but it's for the broader movement, because we know that this is a test case. And so winning outside of the courtroom, showing corporations that, you know, it's not just Greenpeace that you're going after. You have brought all of civil society. This is a visible fight. We're all watching it. The world is watching. We're all paying attention, and we're going to support Greenpeace. That is what is going to create a deterrent effect for other corporations that are looking at this tactic. So winning in the courtroom, absolutely our priority. We know that the law is on our side, but we are approaching this in a much more holistic way because we don't want anyone else to have to go through what we have in these last 8 years.
Deepa Padmanabha, we want to thank you for being with us. Senior legal advisor for Greenpeace USA, speaking to us from Mandan, will be in court today, as she has been on the other days of this civil trial. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. To look more at the Greenpeace trial and the criminalization of protest movements, we now join by Winona LaDuke, longtime Indigenous activist and author, enrolled member of the Mississippi Band of Anishinaabe, who lives and works at the White Earth Nation Reservation. In 2016, she joined others in solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline to protect water and Indigenous lands in North Dakota. She recently wrote a column for the North Dakota Monitor headlined, "Water Protectors on Trial Again as Greenpeace Case Begins in North Dakota." Winona LaDuke is joining us today from Eugene, Oregon. Winona, welcome back to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Now, the whole issue is, did Greenpeace lead this movement, what others describe as an indigenous-led movement, this moment in 2016, this epic gathering of thousands of indigenous people from North and South America and around the world with their allies at Standing Rock? You were one of them.
Yeah, I had no idea Greenpeace was there, actually. I mean, and I think a lot of Indigenous people didn't. We all came for the water. We came there because Indigenous people, Lakota people, Ladana all called us there. I came because we had just defeated another pipeline in Minnesota that then went, and Enbridge went and purchased 28% of the Energy Transfer Partners pipeline. So, you know, we all went out there for the water. And so I was surprised at this case, but not surprised at the tactics of North Dakota, which is all about squashing any kind of civil dissent, having any kind of democracy, from what I can see. It's very, you know, North Dakota is not a good state in terms of a democracy. We'll put it that way.
And Winona, could you talk about how this case relates to another case in which you were a witness, North Dakota versus USA, and how this fits into the state's push to cover the $38 million they spent on the military presence at Standing Rock?
Yes, of course. I mean, there were thousands of us out there. I was out there for quite a bit of time. I witnessed, you know, everything that Energy Transfer Partners did to the best of my, you know, ability. I saw, you know, that they unleashed dogs on people. So they did, in fact, cause bodily harm to people. We saw it happen. And, you know, there was a lot of military out there. $38 million is what was the toll, they said, the cost for North Dakota. And that was all kind of equipment. Now, North Dakota has been trying to recover that. They got a bunch back, you know, money. Energy Transfer Partners gave them some. But in March of this last year, 2024, I was a federal witness in the North Dakota versus U.S. case in Bismarck. And in that case, the state of North Dakota had alleged that because the Army Corps of Engineers had issued a conditional use permit for the area that we all camped upon, that they suggested that the Army Corps of Engineers had enabled us to all go, called us all to Standing Rock. And so, you know, surprisingly enough, I was a federal witness, which I've never been a federal witness, but the federal government called me up and asked me if I would testify if I went to Standing Rock because they issued a permit. I said, hell no. I went there because LaDonna asked me to go. I went there for the water. So North Dakota has been trying to figure out how to kind of save face and have somebody else pay for what they did, put the blame on someone else for their poor behavior and their selling of the state of North Dakota, selling of the water of North Dakota over the human rights of not just indigenous people, but everyone. So I was a federal witness in March of last year, and I've been watching these cases. There's been a lot of cases in North Dakota, and they have not gone well for water protectors. You know, there was 800 people charged, and most of those cases were dismissed by the North Dakota courts under this, I think it's called qualified immunity, which is when you can, like, you know, shoot at water protectors, and it's considered qualified immunity, even if you're on the turret of a tank, basically volleying rounds at people. So, you know, North Dakota has really been trying to squash any kind of resistance. And this Greenpeace case is very significant to North Dakota because if they can, you know, try to shut down Greenpeace, they're going to shut down everybody, including all those farmers who don't want the new carbon sequestration pipelines coming their way. You know, this is how North Dakota is trying to operate.
Winona, I want to ask you about the former North Dakota governor, Doug Burgum, who is now Secretary of the Interior, right? He replaces the first indigenous cabinet member, who was Deb Haaland. Burgum is a major supporter of oil and gas drilling to oversee the bureaucracy tasked with managing U.S. lands and natural resources. So I want to go back to 2017 when he ordered an eviction of a resistance camp set up by Lakota water protectors opposing DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline. As governor, he has signed a near total abortion ban into law, ban on trans girls and women participating in school sports, legislation banning the teaching of critical race theory. That's just background on him. Now in charge of land around the country, the significance of that and how it affects what you're doing.
Well, the other thing is that he's a former executive. I think it's in Great Plains Microsoft. And so basically Burgum has been selling North Dakota to the big tech companies or AI for these centers that, you know, are out there in the middle of like Ellensdale, North Dakota, setting up, you know, huge energy systems, talking about mini nukes to power all the AI, you know, facilities that he wants to put in North Dakota. So Burgum's idea of what North Dakota should look like is not a good idea for North Dakota at all. And the fact that he's now Secretary of Interior means that he's going to try to take the North Dakota model and make it bigger. You know, Doug Burgum is not a friend of Indian people.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Winona. Winona LaDuc, longtime Indigenous activist and author, enrolled member of the Mississippi Band of Anishinaabe, who lives and works on the White Earth Nation Reservation in northern Minnesota, author of To Be a Water Protector, The Rise of the Wendigo Slayers. We'll link to a recent column in the North Dakota Monitor headlined Water Protectors on Trial Again as Greenpeace Case Begins in North Dakota. Coming up, we look at the Oscar-nominated film Sugarcane, an investigation into the devastating abuse at Indian residential schools in Canada. Stay with us.
I've been lost in
Me River by Ray Zaragoza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Sunday night, the Academy Awards were given out. One of the documentaries that was nominated for an Oscar was Sugarcane. The film looks at the abuse of Indigenous children at Catholic Church-run residential schools across Canada, where they face psychological, physical, and sexual violence, often at the hands of priests. Thousands of children, including babies, infants, died of neglect and were killed at the residential schools, with unmarked graves being found to this day. This is the trailer for Sugarcane.
I felt dirty as an Indian all my life in residential school.
Look at that. It's all names.
When you're brought up in an institution like the Catholic Church, you have strict rules and you went with their ethics.
I've been trying to find out what happened at St. Joseph's Mission.
Everything was so secretive.
My dad was born there.
How did it happen?
It's not something that you want to open up, you know. It just keeps on damaging.
For decades, there were reports of neglect and children dying or disappearing from this facility.
Two girls drowned. Priests were moved around.
Why are they dying? Did they think we'd be stupid? All of our lives, the rest of our lives, and nobody would ever find out these things.
Being sorry for something is just the first step. You have to take action.
We see the impacts in our community every single day.
And we need to continue to hold each other up.
Julian, I ask you to open your heart. Our people are going to stand up.
Your story is someone who was abandoned, but also who abandoned.
You do know what happened with me, right?
I want to know the whole story.
The trailer for Sugarcane, co-directed by Julian Brave Noisecat and Emily Cassie, who both join us now from Los Angeles. Julian Brave Noisecat made history as the first indigenous filmmaker from North America to be nominated for an Academy Award in the Best Documentary Feature category. His father is the only known survivor of the practice of infanticide at the St. Joseph's Mission School in Williams Lake, British Columbia. Julian's new op-ed for the New York Times is headlined, "I Told a Native Story That Earned an Oscar Nomination. There Are So Many More to Tell." And Emily Cassie is an award-winning filmmaker and investigative journalist. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I'm still reeling from watching your film last night on Hulu, from watching Sugarcane. Julian, I want to begin with you as the son of a man who survived the practice of infanticide, if that makes sense to people. If you can talk about how you ended up joining Emily in this. At first, you weren't sure if you wanted to do this, but what it meant to focus on the St. Joseph mission.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again, Amy. It's always a pleasure to be on Democracy Now! You know, we're incredibly proud of our film, Sugarcane. It tells an untold and largely unknown story, especially here in the United States, about a system of attempted cultural genocide. Six generations of Indigenous children forcibly separated from their families for over 150 years and sent to segregated boarding schools where they were often abused and sometimes far worse happened. Our film follows an investigation at one of those schools, St. Joseph's Mission, near Williams Lake, British Columbia, Canada. It happens to be the school that my family was sent to. But, you know, when I first actually discussed the possibility of working on a documentary on this subject with Emily, it was just generally about Indian residential schools. And this really crazy thing happened, which you can read a little bit more about in the New York Times, where I told her I'd have to think about being able to work on a film on that subject at all because it was such a personal and heavy subject. She went off and found a First Nation that was going to begin its own investigation. When I circled back around to tell her that I was open to collaborating with her, she told me that the investigation that she'd secured access to follow was at St. Joseph's Mission, which, as you might imagine, was a really crazy, beshared kismet moment. Because, of course, that's the school that my family was sent to and where my father was born. And in telling this story, of course, we're telling a personal and familial story, but we're also trying to tell a story that's representative of the experience of an entire people here in North America.
And Julian, did the members of your family ever talk about their experiences? Could you talk about what you learned growing up?
Yeah, you know, I did not grow up on the Canem Lake Indian Reserve, which is the reservation that my family comes from, but I spent a lot of summers and holidays going back. When I was in college, I actually lived there over the summers and spent my time learning Sequet Mochchin, which is our language. It was a language that was actually nearly wiped out by St. Joseph's Mission and the Indian residential schools. And I learned that language from Ikea, who is one of the participants in our documentary. And if you're learning a language from your grandmother, that's what Ikea means, you know, who was sent to one of these schools and who nearly lost that language because of them, you know, you might ask questions about what happened at those schools. And from the little bit that I had heard from her, which was essentially a couple of stories, one about how she was not supposed to be sent at all and her family tried to hide her in a cabin in the woods, and another about how at the school, you know, they would call the priests and nuns Kinkeknum, meaning the black bear, because not only they wore black, but because they were also predators. You know, I really got the understanding that this was a very painful experience, one that she was not comfortable speaking about at all, and one wherein the silence, the colonial silence that exists in our broader society about this history, you know, also had seeped into the lives of the people who had survived it, who were suppressing some often very painful memories, and that was a very significant part of our intergenerational trauma as Indigenous peoples.
Julian, before we also bring Emily into this conversation, I said in the lead that your father was the only known survivor of the practice of infanticide. Can you describe
how he was found as an infant?
So my father was born at or near St. Joseph's Mission near Williams Lake, British Columbia. Our understanding is that he was likely born in the fourth floor of the dormitories there. My grandmother was a student at that school, but by the time my father was born, she was 20 years old. She'd actually just started as a nurse in the nearby settlement of Williams Lake. He was discarded into a garbage burner, a trash incinerator at the school after he was born, under circumstances that we still do not fully understand, though logic would tell you that it would be impossible for someone who just delivered a baby to get up and walk that baby to a garbage burner. So there's a question of who else might have been present. And about 20 minutes or so later, give or take, he was discovered by a man named Antonius Stoop, who was a Dutchman from the old country who worked at the school. He's sometimes described as a dairyman in sources, other times as the night watchman. And it very notably, given that my last name is Noisecat, his cries for life were described by Tony Stoop as sounding like the noise of a cat. So it was a very, it's a very crazy, somewhat spiritual, but also it's a story about not just what the schools did to Native people, but then how that colonial oppression then shaped our relationships to ourselves and some of the ways that we internalized and perpetuated that abuse across generations and that abandonment across generations, which is also something that impacted my own life, as you see in Sugar Kill.
I'd like to bring Emily Cassie into the conversation. Emily, you've covered human rights abuses globally from Afghanistan to Niger. What drew you to investigate the legacy of Canada's residential schools?
Yeah, so I have done this work and sought to understand why we exact violence on one another. That comes from my own family history and community growing up amongst Holocaust survivors and their descendants. And I heard about the unmarked graves in May of 2021, and I realized in that moment that I had looked for these answers all around the world, but I had never looked in my own backyard at what had happened and the genocide that was perpetrated in my own country. I was born and raised in Toronto. The last year of the residential schools was in 1997, which was my first year of kindergarten. And yet we were taught nothing about it. I knew virtually nothing until I had become a journalist and a filmmaker and had learned a little bit. So when that news broke, I felt this kind of gut pull to the story. And there were two things I did that day. One was reach out to Julianne. Jules and I had worked our first reporting jobs together almost a decade ago. We had been randomly sat at the desks next to each other, and he had gone on to become a very prolific writer and journalist looking at Indigenous life in North America. And when he told me he'd think about it, I went looking for a nation that was going to do a search, and I happened to find this article in the Williams Lake Tribune about Chief Willie Sellers. And I wrote him a cold email, and Chief Sellers called me back, and he said, "The creator has always had great timing. Just yesterday, our council said we need someone to document our search." Of course, as Julianne said, little did I know that I had ended up selecting the very school where Julianne's family attended and where his father's life began out of those 139 in Canada and 417 in the United States.
I wanted to go back to 2022 when Pope Francis made a historic trip to Canada to apologize for the mistreatment suffered by Indigenous children in residential schools run by the Catholic Church.
I myself wish to reaffirm this with shame and unambiguously humbly beg forgiveness for the evil committed by so many Christians against the Indigenous peoples.
Can you, Julian, talk about the significance of this moment? Now the Pope lays in hospital, is very, very sick. But what happened there? And also Prime Minister Trudeau, what this means and what kind of reparations are being made, if that's at all possible?
In Sugarcane, we have a political diptych close to the sort of crescendo in the narrative where First, you see the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, visit the Williams Lake First Nation and issue his own sort of preemptive apology to beat the Pope to the punch, which is, just as an aside, a very Canadian, liberal Canadian thing to do, to be the first one to say sorry. And we hope that our viewers sort of understand the humor in that, even though it's, you know, obviously a very serious subject. And then we follow a survivor of St. Joseph's Mission, the late Chief Rick Gilbert, to the Vatican, where he attends the papal apology to survivors of Indian residential schools in Canada. And, you know, Emily actually had to sneak into the Vatican to record that, because the Catholic Church, even when it comes to apologies, kind of shockingly, is still incredibly controlling as to what narratives it allows to be told about itself and its actions. And, you know, in that moment, the Pope actually chose to deliver that apology in Italian. So, many of the attendees, you know, themselves still faithful Catholics, despite everything that happened to them at these schools, actually were not able to really process and understand the apology that was being given to them in that moment, which I think, you know, in the film and in broader society should beg the question of what would it actually mean to apologize, you know, and what would that mean in a truly Catholic sense of atonement? You know, our film, while it takes on the wrongs of the Catholic Church, also, you know, I think is quite even-handed in portraying the way that our elders in particular in my community remain committed to the Catholic Church and actually often survived some of the abuses they suffered at the hands of representatives of that faith, you know, with a rosary in their hand, by praying to, you know, God and Jesus and the Great Spirit in the way that they learned at the schools, which I think is a very complicated part of this history that I think is also very human. You know, I think we remain attached to things that sometimes also harm us.
I'll just add as well that, you know, this moment was, there was a real feeling of emptiness in the room. You know, the apologies mean something to some people, and that matters. And of course, the film was part of Joe Biden's historic apology as well. But it's not nearly enough. The Catholic Church has refused to open their records to Indigenous communities so that their survivors can at least know the truth. That's the same with the U.S. and Canadian government. And of course, the Catholic Church, you know, apologized for the actions of individuals, you know, the actual institution, which moved priests around as they knew they were abusing them. And, you know, though Julian's father was the only known survivor of the incinerator, we know that there were a lot more babies at St. Joseph's Mission, potentially other schools, who were either adopted out into white families after being, many of them, born to priests, like the late chief Rick Gilbert was, you know, his father was the principal of the school. That's the individual that we follow to the Vatican. He was carrying that dark secret in his very own DNA. And other babies we know were also found in the school's incinerator, babies who were born at the school. So this is a pattern that was insidious. And those harms have never been acknowledged by the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church has not acknowledged the film or what was uncovered for the first time in it.
We just have 20 seconds, but Julian and Emily have just come from the Academy Awards ceremony. Julian, how did it feel to make history as the first Indigenous filmmaker from North America to be nominated in the documentary category?
In any category, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really beautiful, you know, to see in particular my father, my auntie Charlene, who's in the film, Chief Willie, also in the film on the red carpet. You know, it just signified that we had something really special here in this film, and that the broader world was getting an opportunity to see that. And, you know, we wanted to give Indian country a reason to hold their heads high, and I think we did.
Well, you certainly did. Julian Brave Noise Cat and Emily Cassie, you did such an incredible job. It is an unforgettable documentary. Co-directors of the Oscar-nominated film Sugarcane. We'll link to Julian's piece in the New York Times headlined, "I Told a Native Story That Earned an Oscar Nomination. There Are So Many More to Tell." Coming up, we remember Aaron Bushnell, the 25-year-old active-duty Air Force member who self-immolated a year ago outside the Israeli embassy in D.C. We'll speak to a friend as well as an active-duty soldier who
has applied for CO status, conscientious objector. Back in 30 seconds. Fading out something I've been afraid to do. But when it takes everything, I guess you take it. Song for Aaron Bushnell by Islands. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show remembering Aaron Bushnell. A year ago last week, February 25th, 2024, Aaron Bushnell self-immolated outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. to protest the U.S. support for Israel and Gaza. Bushnell posted a message online that read, quote, "Many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I was alive during slavery or the Jim Crow South? Or apartheid? What would I do if my country was committing genocide? The answer is, you're doing it right now," unquote. A few hours later, Aaron Bushnell walked towards the Israeli embassy in D.C. wearing his Air Force uniform. He began the live stream on his phone and spoke as he approached the embassy gates.
"I am an active duty member of the United States Air Force, and I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I'm about to engage in an extreme act of protest, but compared to what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, it's not extreme at all. This is what our ruling class has decided will be normal."
Aaron Bushnell then placed his phone on the ground, stood in front of the Israeli embassy gate, and doused himself in a liquid before setting himself on fire. He shouted "Free Palestine" several times as he was consumed by the flames. Those were his last words. Last week, vigils were held outside the Israeli embassy and the White House to remember Aaron Bushnell. Today, we're joined by two guests. Lieutenant Joy Metzler is an active duty Air Force lieutenant who just wrote a piece for Mondo Weiss headlined, "I'm seeking a discharge from the U.S. military over the Gaza genocide. I was inspired by Aaron Bushnell." She helped launch service members for ceasefire. She's joining us from Florida. And in Baltimore, we're joined by Levi Pierpont, who met Aaron Bushnell at basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in May 2020. Pierpont went on to become a conscientious objector. He recently posted a piece on his website titled "The Hardest Sacrifices to Live, Reflections on Collectivism 1 Year After My Friend's Self-Immolation." Levi, let's begin with you. Your thoughts on this first anniversary of Aaron Bushnell. I think it's very significant that you said the hardest sacrifice is to live.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. Obviously, it's surreal to think that it's been a year. A lot has happened in that year. We've seen a lot play out on the global stage, and a lot has changed in my life. And so it's just, it's been a time to look back on that and a time to reflect. And I was glad to be able to do this with this piece and share things that I've been thinking about in the last few months leading up to this anniversary.
And Levi, could you talk about the impact that that Aaron's death had on you, his sacrifice?
Of course, yes. It was major. It was life-changing. I went from that and got involved in student activism at the University of Michigan. In August, I went to Palestine. I went from being someone who had grown up Christian Zionist and was very sympathetic to Zionism to realizing how it's interconnected with the American empire and realizing how we need to stand against it as Americans. Because we're implicated in it. It's our money that's going to this. And so, it has majorly impacted my life and introduced me to a lot of different spaces.
I want to bring Joy into this conversation, who's joining us from Florida. Joy Metzler, active duty Air Force lieutenant, just wrote a piece for Mondo Weiss. I'm seeking a discharge from the U.S. military over the Gaza genocide. I was inspired by Aaron Bushnell. You really have not done a global TV radio interview before, but talk about what you're doing right now and what this first anniversary means for you as a lieutenant seeking CO status.
Hey, Amy, thanks for having me on. First of all, I'm very honored to be here. And I do need to preface everything I say with that these views don't reflect any official policy of the DOD or the United States Air Force, but they are feelings that I feel I wish a lot of service members would reflect. But this first anniversary coming around was particularly difficult for me because of this concept of moral injury, which is it's a mental condition where you are being forced to engage with something that conflicts with your morals. And it's something that actually a lot of service members do tend to struggle with it, but it's not as researched as something, for instance, PTSD. And for me, this really manifests in still having to go to work every day. And a lot of people, I think, might question what I personally have to do with this genocide going on in Gaza. But I believe deeply in the idea of collective responsibility, and that any kind of contribution to the U.S. military inherently helps this machine of warfare and imperialism and oppression continue. And so I think that was something that Aaron Bushnell felt strongly. And he, of course, started me on this journey towards my own self-discovery. And I'm not sure how long it took him to get to that point where he absolutely reached his breaking point and could not continue contributing to this system. But I feel like perhaps I can understand maybe a small fraction of what he feels still having to be in the uniform service while I watch my country continually fund a genocide that has not stopped.
And Joy Metzler, could you talk about your journey? You were raised in a conservative Christian family. You've said in an interview that you were raised to believe that Israel is, quote, the nation of God's chosen people. How has your understanding of the Middle East conflict and Israel's war on Palestinians changed?
So, yes, I grew up with many of the same talking points that people still try and use today to justify these humanitarian rights violations against the Palestinians. I grew up believing that anything Israel does is good. Anything they do has to be ordained by God or something along those lines. On a more political world politics side, I grew up thinking that Israel was our greatest and only ally in the Middle East, and the Middle East was full of people who wanted to kill us for no reason. And that sentiment continued and persisted throughout the academy. There's no real effort to try and change that sentiment, even though we had a common saying among the cadets, among my friends, that if you kill a terrorist, you create two more. And it's that fundamental misunderstanding of terrorism and where it comes from that I think is continuing to fuel this fire. It almost permits terrible acts to be committed against people who are even marginally connected to terrorism. And you see that word being thrown around, being used to describe people who just want Palestinians to have human rights. My journey to get to that point of thinking was a pretty long one. I had to tear down, first of all, my definition of terrorism. I had to tear down the propaganda that I had been fed, that terrorists just kind of hate us because of who we are. I had to learn a lot. I had to supplement my understanding of the U.S.'s place in the global world order.
We have 10 seconds, Joy.
With history, based on, you know, the oppression of the U.S. military and regions. So that's really how I got to where I am now.
I want to thank you both for being with us. I want to thank Lieutenant Joy Metzler, active duty Air Force Lieutenant seeking conscientious objector status, and Levi Pierpont, who is a conscientious objector, a friend of Aaron Bushnell. They met at Air Force basic training in Texas. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren of Trina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astujo. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81.